This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, marvel at how language is getting 20 million views for contouring tutorials on YouTube. Today's episode is another instalment about minority languages, the threats they face and what they do to survive. But now, on with the show.
And I remember saying to a friend of mine, I used to have another language. I used to be able to speak another language. And she was like, speak it then. And I remember not having anything. I couldn't say anything.
This is Ishbel McFarlane, a theatre maker and campaigner for the Scots language. Although for many years of her life, she did not want anything to do with the Scots language at all.
So my mum and dad deliberately brought me up speaking Scots when I was wee. Partly because they'd both grown up in moderately complicated but Scots language environments, and they were themselves Scots language campaigners. So they really wanted me to have access to it. So that would be my sort of home language. But then, because of a whole load of reasons, centrally that it's not seen as a language by many people, I wasn't allowed to use it at primary school or at nursery or playgroup, or even when I was with my friends, their parents.
There's no name for our language apart from shut up or don't talk like that.
Dr. Michael Dempster is a neurolinguist whose first language was Scots. That's what his family spoke in the home.
Certainly, I think my parents were aware of Scots Standard English being the best way to speak if you're going to school. And doing that, and the value of speaking like that. So there was a lot of correcting of the way that I spoke, and you were disciplined within school all the time about your language, and ridiculed. Teachers would ridicule. When I entered school in Scotland, we had the TOS, which was a belt, a leather belt with three or two thongs for corporal punishment.
And when was this? What decade was this?
So this would be the 1980s.
Wow.
So I was the first year that didn't get the belt. And everyone that I've spoken to who's older than me had some experience of being belted for using their language. So corporal punishment was used to police language. You would often get sent to the head teacher for your terrible language.
Or even if you were sent to be punished for something else, it could end up being a punishment for your language.
I remember the first time I was sent, it was for playing with chucky stains out in the playground. Chucky stains, so small pebbles, or no, smaller than pebbles, like bits of gravel thrown at about. And there was a few of us were sent to the head teacher. And the punishment was not, initially it was for throwing stones, right? And by the time we got to the head teacher, we were asked what we did to be sent there, and we were just flinging wee stains about, wee chuckies about, so speaking in Scots.
And suddenly, they weren't in trouble for throwing stones, they were in trouble for using Scots.
Immediately the teacher attacked our language, and not the actual scenario that resulted in us being sent to be told off, you know, for flicking stones at one another. Immediately it was about the language, and the teacher was threatening and explaining to us that we would have been hit with the belt had we been there a year earlier, and our language was terrible, it was disgusting, it was all these negative adjectives. And that was kind of persistent throughout school, you know. And by my time it was language was being used violently towards the children for they're using Scots within the school context. And that was my experience growing up throughout much of the school system, being ridiculed and attacked for my language by teachers and other adults. And that still goes on today.
What does that do to you, like growing up in that environment where the language that you've grown up speaking is so off limits?
I think it destroys people's confidence in being able to communicate publicly. People are terrified to engage with doctors, to engage with local politicians, to speak in any way publicly.
And so I didn't want to speak it at all, and I wouldn't let my mum and dad speak it at all. And they were worried I was being bullied because I was speaking it. And so I switched to English because that was the language that had all the kudos. That was the one that was going to get you jobs, etc. And then there's also a sort of almost panicked, you won't get a job if you speak like that. So while my mum and dad were using Scots with me, and if I used an English word, they'd say, yeah, you can use either. You know, so for example, they'd say, put your breeks on, and I'd say trousers, because I'd heard that was what you should be saying. And they'd say, yeah, breeks or trousers. You can use either word. Whereas my grandma would say, nope, do not use breeks, use trousers. you can't get jobs if you use the word breeks. Even though, you know, farming, everyone spoke Scots.
So your parents were really trying to avoid giving you the association of shame and Scots.
Yeah, definitely.
But you got it anyway.
Got it anyway. Yeah.
It was actually quite an eye-opener seeing as an adult how Scots is policed in public life and how the prestige of the language is policed publicly. So working professionally speaking, giving public lectures and things like that, that in Scotland, where the vast majority of the people who were in the audience would understand the Scots, I was going to say, there would be a visceral rejection of that language in that context. Most people speak standard Scottish English, so that's English with a Scottish accent, and these events. And it's very rare for people to publicly use Scots. So because Scots language exists on a continuum with English with a Scots accent and then English with an English accent.
So it's very close to English. A lot of people just think of it as rubbish English.
But it isn't. So what is it, Ishbel?
Scots is a Germanic language, like English, and shares an ancestor with English in Anglo-Saxon. So that's a language of people who invaded England and travelled up England into Scotland in the 7th and 8th century. And then as the borders between England and Scotland started to become more defined, they developed very separately, particularly because what we now consider English is an English that grew up right in the southeast of England. So Scots had interaction with English, but it also had its own influences, particularly from French, Flemish. We kept a lot more Latin, and it developed in its own way. So first major languages spoken in Scotland is Pictish, right? And Pictish is genocided out by Irish Gaelic, which then becomes Scots Gaelic as it's further away from Ireland. So the Gaelic becomes the language of Scotland. And then the Anglo-Saxons come up from Denmark through the north of England and start creating Scots in the southeast of Scotland around Edinburgh. And then that starts growing and pushing through the lowlands up the northeast and deliberately eradicating Gaelic. The famous king is David I, who deliberately made these borough towns, like in England. He'd grown up in England, and he put Anglo-Saxon speakers in them. And so the Gaelic speakers in the area, if they wanted to trade or sell anything, they suddenly had to be able to speak Anglo-Saxon, this ancestor of Scots.
Common story that a language achieves prestige because of commercial pressures. Another classic factor is religious authority.
The Geneva Bible in Scotland was the voice of God, and that was in English.
The Geneva Bible was the first Bible to be printed in Scotland, and in 1579 a law was passed in Scotland ordering every household with sufficient means to buy it. So that is some effective marketing for the superior authority of English. Thirdly, royalty spawns trends, then as now. When Kate Middleton wears a coat, it sells out. And when King James VI of Scotland becomes the King of England as well in 1603, people want to speak like the big lad speaks.
He's a native Scots speaker. So he wrote poetry in Scots and his laws in Scots when he was king in Scotland. And then when he becomes King of England as well, he moves to London, partly because English people are like, we don't want a Scots king. Like, we hate that because they've been at war with Scotland so often, you know, within living memory. And so he moves to London to sort of appease that. And also, London is richer than Edinburgh. So it's nice to go somewhere where there's lots of gold and all this kind of stuff. And he suddenly switches. And Scots and Gaelic are languages which make people vulgar and ungovernable. And so it's explicitly the language that does it.
Got to put distance between your new favourite thing and the old ways.
This king who had been writing in Scots, suddenly everybody has to speak English as spoken in London. And that wasn't the case. You know, Northumberland English in the north of England would be much, almost as different from London English as Edinburgh Scots, you know. So that sort of variety suddenly becomes a threat to nationhood.
I think also when there's longer range transport and mass communication and mass media, the language starts to become a lot more homogenous.
Absolutely. Yeah. By the time you get to the 18th century and you're creating a polite society.
I mean, what is that about?
Yeah, I mean, that new polite society has newspaper, national newspapers and things like that for the first time. People need to think the same way, have the same rules, because suddenly you're not just interacting with the, like, 1,000 people in your local area. Yeah, you need to be selling things in Manchester and going to find work in London, and you need to be fitting in. And David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, who's, you know, very proud Scot and incredibly clever, you know, and leading the Enlightenment and changing the history of Western civilization. At the back of his books on philosophy, he had little handy, helpful tips about how to stop writing Scots, how to exercise Scottishness from your writing, because the English of London becomes rational and objective, and people start to forget that it's also a dialect.
What kind of rules did he outline?
So, for example, his own name, Hume, that in Scots would generally have been spelled H-O-M-E, mm-hmm. and that would be Hume. But in Southeast English, you would read that as home. So he switched the spelling of his name to H-U-M-E and used that consistently. And he had a friend who always deliberately kept spelling his name H-O-M-E. In his will, he left this guy like a bushel of wine or something, on the understanding he would only get it if he never ever used the spelling H-O-M-E again. He always used the English spelling.
An interesting effect is about enunciation. If you don't hear what somebody says in Scotland, if you say what, generally, if they say, oh, I've got a sore head, and you say what, they'll say, I have a sore head. So people enunciate in standard English, and that's it's part of training children and the kind of sociolinguistic hierarchy. As if somebody speaks Scots, a parent or an authority figure will say what, and the expectation is to reply in an enunciated standard English.
There are a lot of people who are keen to erase their own minority language use or dialect use because they've internalised that message that it holds them back.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's definitely the model of top-down suppression, where the law says that you can't use it in a classroom and the teacher stops you using it. But, you know, that is, as you say, internalised, and people police themselves and each other really strongly. And people do it sometimes aggressively and a lot with humour, in ways that they don't understand how problematic that can be.
People were being visibly excluded for their language, and that was something that it kind of reminded me of growing up in that context. If you used Scots, and I've watched it in shopping centres and things like that, if Scots gets used, security guards follow those people. You know, so there's a suspicion there, and there's an exclusion from speaking. I've seen people thrown out of museums, and really all they've done is spoke Scots.
People will stop someone else, like, in a queue. So, for example, they is a Scots word for those, T-H-A-E, they. That's definitely seen as wrong English by people. And so someone I know was in a queue, and this wee boy was like, can I have two of they ones about sweets or something? And somebody like three folk back said, it's not they, it's those. You know? And it's like, who does that? Who just interrupts somebody and corrects them? But we do it with language all the time.
You learn the places where it's acceptable. Just from my own personal experience, actually speaking in public after having a lifetime of kind of ridicule was incredibly difficult at first. And then after that, I spoke only in English in public. After about a decade of speaking in museums and teaching, and I decided to speak Scots, it was incredibly difficult. And it was surprisingly hard to actually move across into speaking Scots publicly.
Just to make it more confusing, some major Scottish culture is in Scots language. So even when children were forbidden to use Scots colloquially at school, they still encountered it through the work of the revered poet Robert Burns.
Robert Burns is our national poet. Wrote Auld Lang Syne and My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose, apparently Bob Dylan's favourite song. that we're very proud of him, particularly in January. Our big national holiday really is Burns Night. And so children learn Burns poems and other Scots poems in January. And then the rest of the year, they're in terrible trouble if they use Scots.
The hostility of that kind of public space, I think, how you interact with that is certainly going to have massive neurological and physiological effects upon people.
So even though in the last few years Scots has become more visible and respected, Scots speakers won't necessarily transform their attitudes towards their own language as quickly. There's a very complex relationship between it and the culture and the national identity.
Scotland's always trying to negotiate being part of Britain and having its own cultural identity, or identities. There are multiple ones that go back. You know, I mean, Scotland was one of the early medieval kingdoms, as was England and France, you know. So it's something that language and nationalism, they're related, but I would like to say that because Scotland is essentially trilingual in terms of kind of native languages, Scottish Standard English, Scots and Gaelic, they're not quite becoming nationalist footballs, you know. They're not neither British nationalists or Scottish nationalists or want to use Scots as that. I think it's important we keep it that way because there are other nationalistic movements that have the language at the centre of their movement.
As discussed in the episode about Welsh Patagonia, the Welsh language was protected by the Welsh Language Act of 1967 and promoted by being used in TV and radio and public writing, such as bilingual road signs all over the country. But the Scots language has not, so far, had these formal campaigns for public usage.
That's one of the things, it's one of the questions in the Scots language community. Do we have this written representation of Scots in an official capacity? And also for things like public buildings, should they have multilingual signs? So, OOT, having double OT for exit.
A little bit of Scots language by every doorway.
So the idea is, and if you make it more and more visible, then people become more used to using it in a public context. But then it comes into the question about who is actually implementing Scots language. Within written Scots, there's a expository register of Scots, which is largely come into existence from non-Scots speakers who are trying to, they're treating Scots as a dead language, and they basically try to reconstruct Scots from historical documents, whereas Scots, as modern Scots spoken, is very far from dead.
Also, if you're reconstructing a language from documents, it's not really going to resemble the one that people actually use, is it?
No. Well, that's a real issue. So there's that alienates a lot of people, and it's something that I think we've got to be very careful of with supporting Scots and encouraging people to use their Scots, because people are presented by something that's alien to them. To give like an English context to that, if you were presented by Shakespeare in English and told that that was English and you were speaking it incorrectly, then you're going to say, I don't speak English. I don't know what I speak, but if that's English, I don't speak that. So that's one of the issues that that can come up.
Also, a thing that happens a lot is people talk about old Scots words. So they'll say, bairn is an old Scots word for child. And I'll say, first is currently in use. That'd be a word that's used by literally millions of people in Scotland. 1.5 million people in Scotland reported themselves as Scots speakers in the last census. But it's actually a younger word than the word child. So why don't we say child is an old English word for young person? The sort of oldness of Scots is a way of kind of distancing it from, like, the cut and thrust of contemporary life.
Language lives when it adapts to modern needs. And fortunately, the Scots language is not staying a historic reconstruction.
There is a confidence in speaking it or even as well, and particularly with social media. The online presence of Scots has been there right from the start of the World Wide Web. Within a year of the World Wide Web, people in Scotland were calling it the WAB and Wabsteeds. So there's a native name for it, you know, for it that's just as old as website, you know, or nearly as old as websites. So Scots has got a technical language as well, you know. People engage with computer training and it, you know, shut the windy and things like that.
Now you can get the Gruffalo in Scots, you can get Winnie the Pooh in Scots, you can get Harry Potter in Scots. Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. Stop! I forbid ye! Yelled Uncle Vernon in panic. Ach, I won't bail your heeds, the baith he is, said Hagrid. Harry, you're a warlock. And that's a great way in for young readers and for parents.
But now you'll see small Scots dictionaries about, and people have started to, particularly within like crafting world and all that, people use Scots words in their craft. They're coming to actually accept that there's a cultural value to the language. I'm quite confident that it's on the up.
Michael Dempster and Ishbel McFarlane both work with the Scots Language Centre to promote Scots and campaign for greater visibility of the language. Find out more at scotslanguage.com. Ishbel McFarlane delivers training on Scotland's minority languages and she's a performer. Look out for her solo show about the Scots language, O Is For Hoolit. You can keep track of her at Ishbel McF on Twitter. Find out more about Michael Dempster's writing and academic work at mindyourlanguage.scot. He's also been translating songs and operas into Scots. There's a performance of his version of Dido and Aeneas in August through the Scots Opera Project. I'll link to Michael and Ishbel's work at theallusionist.org/Scots. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is eudaimonic, adjective, conducive to happiness. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me and Martin Austwick, who also does the music for this show. And on the show's website, you can hear every episode of The Allusionist by numerous different means. Also on The Allusionist site are transcripts of each episode, the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, notes and extra reading about every episode, social media links, everything allusional is there. Pay a visit to theallusionist.org.